of Defense is mandating the vaccine. That is bringing anxiety, uncertainty, and lots of questions for service members. Hi, I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is a special edition of First Liberty Live. Did you know our program, by the way, is also available as a podcast? You can just search for First Liberty Live on any of the major podcast outlets. You can listen to the audio in your car, around the house while you're working, wherever you like. It's just one more way we're trying to get the word out about these important topics that we talk about here. We ask you questions, and now we're going to get some answers. I've got Mike Berry here. He's general counsel for First Liberty Institute. He watches over military affairs for us. He also served overseas in the Marines and is currently a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve. Hi, Mike.
Morning.
It's good to have you here. Thank you for being here and answering some of these questions for us. We're going to offer insights today, but we want to make sure you understand that every specific situation is different. So before you make any decisions, you'll want to get advice from your own attorney. We're offering insights and telling you what the law is, but everybody needs to follow their own attorney's advice and make decisions on their own, because they can have very important consequences and sometimes very serious consequences. We'll be specifically focusing today on the legal atmosphere, the legal environment for people who have religious concerns concerning the vaccine. We're not going to offer medical advice. We're not telling people whether you should take the vaccine or not. That's a decision for you. But what we can tell you is what's in and out as far as the law is concerned. And we ask people for questions, and we've got a series of them here. And we're going to call them up on the big screen one at a time, Mike, and I'll toss them to you. We got a dozen of them. We got a lot more than that that people sent to us, but I think these questions we're going to ask you summarize the ones that we got by email that people sent in. First, what is your advice for how to prepare the strongest possible religious accommodation that someone can hand in?
Well, my advice is, before I even give the advice, I want to lay down some ground rules. First, as you said, Stuart, I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not here to dispense any medical advice. I am a constitutional attorney, but the mere fact that we are doing this Q&A does not create an attorney-client relationship between First Liberty and anybody who might be viewing us.
Right.
I'm not your attorney, right? I'm just here to offer guidance, wisdom, best practices, but this is not a substitute for the legal advice that you can and should seek from your attorney. But that said, just as you laid out, Stuart, there are a lot of common questions that we continue to receive, you know, by the dozen or by the hundreds. And what we've tried to do is really consolidate those into, you know, a lot of questions are very similar or sort of picking at very similar issues and concepts. So we've tried to consolidate them into about the 12 most common questions we receive. And I'm going to do my best to provide some answers and guidance. And as I said before, it's really to provide some clarity and to help eliminate a lot of the confusion and anxiety that surrounds this.
So we'll describe the environment that these questions are in, but again, you've got to get your own advice from your own attorney. So what about this first one? How do you prepare the strongest possible religious accommodation, that's the exact term, to turn in if you're concerned about this?
Well, so a couple of things that the service member has to do if they want to seek a religious accommodation is one, as the name entails, you have to have a religious belief. It has to be a sincerely held religious belief, and you have to demonstrate that whatever the government's doing, all right, in this case, it's a vaccine mandate, but it could be any number of scenarios. Whatever the government is doing is, in the law, we call it a substantial burden. So you have to show that it's substantially burdening your ability to freely exercise your religious beliefs. In this context, if I have a religious belief that I cannot and should not take this particular vaccine, and as we all are very well aware, the Department of Defense has issued an order, a directive, saying you must take this vaccine, then it's pretty easy to satisfy that, right? To show, okay, there's an order telling me I have to get this vaccine. I have a religious belief, a sincere religious belief that says I cannot get this vaccine. Then you simply show that, right? That the government order, the DOD order to get the vaccine is now substantially burdening my ability to live out my religious beliefs.
Right.
Once you've showed that, all right, then a lot of the questions are, well, do I have to have my pastor, my priest, my chaplain, et cetera? Do I have to have people, you know, letters of sort of proof to show my religious beliefs? The answer is, legally speaking, no. It's not required. You don't have to prove anything beyond your sincere religious belief. And you're and when people say, well, then what could you do to show that you have a sincere religious belief? Legally speaking, it could literally just be your statement. I have this sincere religious belief.
Would it include a strong moral objection if you're not a particularly religious person? Does that still fit into this mold?
Under existing case law, yes. A strong moral objection would also satisfy.
Okay.
Now, obviously at First Liberty, we focus on religious freedom. And so the religious free exercise. So we're really focused on people who have a religious objection. But again, I've explained this to many people, and I think it's important to make this clear. Your religious belief is not up for debate by the government. The government has no business questioning whether your religious belief is reasonable, whether it's valid, whether it's legitimate. I certainly don't mean to be flippant about it, but it could somebody. Could out there say my religious belief is that Darth Vader told me I can't get this vaccine. Now, I realize that sounds there, you know, way out there in left field.
It is.
But if the person is able to establish that that is a sincere religious belief that they hold, and I use the Darth Vader example only because back when I was a young active duty military attorney in the Marine Corps, there is this thing where young Marines began coming to me and saying that their religious belief was Jediism, and so it's just it. And others believe in the Nordic, you know, gods, and just
right.
So. I mean, I'm not taking us down that rabbit hole. I'm just saying that there are many different belief systems out there. It doesn't just have to be Judeo-Christian or Hinduism or Buddhism, etc. There are many different belief systems, and the government has no business saying, "Well, that one's legitimate, but that one's not." Because that puts the government in the position of then deciding which religious beliefs win and which ones lose. And we can't have that in this country.
So as far as the strongest possible religious accommodation, what are some key things that need to be in there?
So like I said, show that you have a sincere religious belief.
Yeah.
You're not required to have these letters of proof from pastors, priests, chaplains, etc.
Okay.
Now, I will say this, though, Stuart. If you decide, that's a personal decision if you want to begin providing amplifying detail about your religious beliefs. And if you decide that you want to include that because that's your personal decision to do that, I will say that I think that that could be helpful. All right, but I want to caution that what we don't want to do is set up a scenario where that now becomes the expectation and sort of the de facto requirement.
Yeah.
Where a government official who's reviewing this says, well, how come this person has a letter from their pastor saying, yeah, this guy's really serious about not wanting the vaccine, and then this guy doesn't have a letter, all right? What we can't have is where the government says, well, again, this one's legitimate because he has a letter. This one's not legitimate.
Because they don't.
That would give that would provide grounds to challenge for the person where the government said that's not legitimate because you don't have a letter from your pastor.
So a simple declarative statement really is the best way to go.
It's not a matter of best. It really comes down to personal preference and choice and what is unique to your circumstances.
Yeah.
That's the key here. So assuming that your request is denied, and this is dovetailing a little bit into question two, but if your request is denied and you end up going down the road to an appeal and
Let's bring that up. I mean, since you're already moving there, the second question is, what is the legal process if that religious accommodation request is denied? So go ahead there.
Yeah, and if it is denied and you end up going down the road of appealing that, all right, then what the Supreme Court has said repeatedly and what the case law and regulations require is what we call an individual analysis, right? It's an individual inquiry. So the government, whoever the adjudicating authority is for the government, they have to do that analysis specific to the individual and their circumstances. And that's why I keep going back and saying it's whatever is most appropriate for your circumstances. If you can provide letters of support and letters of endorsement by your clergy, your religious leaders, etc., and you feel comfortable doing that, because again, you're not required to do it. But if you feel comfortable doing that, then great. And I brought with me, Stuart, two examples, and I don't want to show them to the camera because I don't want to give any personally identifiable information.
Yeah.
But these two examples are from Marine officers who submitted religious accommodation requests. Both requests were pretty specific to their individual circumstances, right, which is exactly what we recommend, right? Tailor your request to your specific beliefs, to your specific circumstances.
Which is also why you need to talk to your own attorney, because everybody's situation is so different.
Right. Well, let me go back to question one again. How do you make the strongest possible request? So in addition to the religious beliefs, I would also suggest including things that are specific about your military position and the duties that you perform. I'll use myself as an example, because I'm willing to, you know, to do that and not to put other people in that position. Right. My particular military duty is such that I work remotely. I do all of my work from behind a computer. I don't have to have any human interaction. I would include that in my request, right? I would explain that and say, I don't have any interpersonal, you know, physical interaction with other service members. So what there is almost zero risk of, you know, a COVID, you know, being spread from one person to another because I have no interaction. So I would include that, those circumstances. Going back to these two denied requests that I was looking at, that's what these service members did. They included information that was specific to their circumstances. One of them is stationed in California. The other one is stationed in North Carolina. Okay, so they submitted unique, specifically tailored requests, 3,000 miles apart,
right,
different commands. All right, they both ended up at the same adjudicatory authority, right, the same decision maker. And the denials that they have, these two denials, other than the names of the people involved, of the people making the request, these denials are literally identical, right? They're carbon copies,
what
verbatim.
What does that tell you?
So what that tells me is that the decision maker here, and I'm not going to name them, but the decision maker, my suspicion and my assumption is that they're using a template to issue blanket denials.
Right.
And you know, this is the proverbial rubber stamp, right? Where it's just, it's the same language that they're using, which is not what the law requires of the government. The law requires, as I said earlier, the government to do an individualized inquiry. It has to be specific to that individual, and they have to address that individual's religious accommodation request and speak to why the government can't accommodate that person and that circumstances. So if you're watching this, and your request is denied, all right, and the question I'm getting is, what do I do if my request is denied? The first thing you should do is look at what the denial says.
Was it specific to what you wrote?
Is it specific to your religious accommodation request? If it is, all right, then it looks like, then in that case, the government's probably doing what it should be doing. But if it's not, and I suspect the vast majority are not going to be specific to your religious accommodation request, they're going to be like these two right here.
Yeah.
I would say, please send us via the email address that's provided, right? Send us that denial in writing so that we can evaluate it. Because if we start to get hundreds of these or thousands of these, that's going to create a very, very compelling case that the government is not following the law and that it's just issuing blanket denials across the board without doing what the law requires.
I was going to mention this at the end of our conversation here, but since you brought it up, if you go to firstliberty.org at the top of the page, there's a link in a little box there that says get legal help, and that is the best way to contact us with that sort of thing, and you can send the information in and we'll work on them. All right.
All right, I spent too much time in the first two questions.
Well, but those are important.
They are.
It takes time to unpack that. You ready for three?
Yes.
All right. What can the military do to me if my accommodation is denied? So they're concerned about what can happen to their career and their future.
Let's unpack this. And this actually ties into sort of an addendum question that I added at the end, because I started to notice a lot of people asking this question.
Yeah.
So while your religious accommodation request is pending, so while it's being reviewed and the decision maker, whoever that is looking at it and deciding whether to approve it or deny it, and even pending appeal, if you decide to appeal a denial, right? Well, let me back up. If it's granted, great, right? You're golden.
All done.
Get the approval in writing, and you better wave that thing around like it's a get out of jail free card, because that's almost what it is in this case, right? Because we're hearing all these horror stories about service members being separated and threatened with court-martial, et cetera. So if it's granted, great. If it's denied, all right, you have the right to appeal the denial. And the service member can appeal the denial within the military up to the service secretary. So if you're a Marine, a sailor, it goes to the Secretary of the Navy, Army, up to the Secretary of the Army, Air Force, Secretary of the Air Force, et cetera. So, but while that is all pending, okay.
What can they do?
They cannot and should not do anything to punish you, to discipline you, right? To what we call in the law adverse employment action. So service members will be familiar with the language I'm using, Article 15 or NJP for not getting the vaccine, removing you from the promotion list, if you're an aviator, removing you from flying status, all these things that we all know and are familiar with as being, you know, adverse action, disciplinary action, adverse administrative action, you know, a general officer memorandum of reprimand, a letter of admonishment, et cetera. If we in the military would consider it to be detrimental to your career and to your advancement, then it's adverse and it can't happen. The other thing that has to happen is during the pendency of your religious accommodation request or any appeal, all right, the military is supposed to treat you as if you are fully compliant with the directive during that time. So that's why they can't take any adverse action, because legally speaking, you're sort of in this middle zone where even though you haven't actually had the vaccine, for legal purposes, they have to treat you as if you have had the vaccine until you have completely exhausted all of your legal and administrative appeal opportunities.
Can they ask you to regularly be tested, for example, though? Is that a reasonable thing?
You know, that's a great question, Stuart. Can you be subjected to regular testing, or can they make you adhere to social distancing and masking? I think the answer to that is probably yes,
yeah.
Right? I mean, there may be circumstances where that's logistically not feasible, but legally speaking, I think that's probably what we would call a reasonable accommodation, right? Is that, okay, we're not going to force you to get the vaccine while your religious accommodation request is making its, what I colloquially refer to as the rat's making its way through the snake, right? Because when a snake eats a rat and you just see the bulge going all the way through.
Yeah.
So while that's happening, it is, I think it is probably legally permissible for them to say, well, at least get tested on a fairly regular basis, probably not, 10 times a day.
Right.
Wear a mask if you're around other people, et cetera. I think those are probably reasonable measures,
okay.
Legally speaking.
All right. This is the fourth one. What does First Liberty Institute believe to be the strongest grounds for appeal? So
okay.
the thought here being you filed for an accommodation, it was denied, now you're appealing it. What's the best case to bring? Is there a general answer to that?
Yes. The strongest grounds for appeal is that the government didn't follow its own regulations. That's what I was pointing out earlier, right? There, federal law requires the government to meet a certain legal standard we call strict scrutiny. So if I'm able to show, going back to question one, I have a sincere religious objection that's being substantially burdened by the government, and the government denies my request for religious accommodation, the government has to show, in order to deny it, they have to show that they have a compelling government interest. In this case, they're going to say, hey, we have to ensure that COVID doesn't continue to spread. That's
right.
Their interest is not in making sure everybody's vaccinated. Making everybody vaccinated is the mechanism by which they achieve their interest. Their interest is in preventing the spread of a virus, right? It could be swine flu or, regular flu or whatever, right? And it could be any number of things. In this case, they're going to say, we have to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
Right.
The way that we do that is through vaccinations. But then if that's not the only question they have to answer, that's just part one. They also have to answer part two. And this is the key to answering this question, what's the strongest grounds for appeal? Is if the government then says, okay, we have this really compelling interest in preventing the spread of COVID, and making people get the vaccine is the least restrictive way of accomplishing that. So least restrictive what, right? It's least restrictive on my religious beliefs. They have to show that there's no less restrictive way against my religious beliefs in order to prevent the spread of COVID.
Okay.
Well, here's a really important fact, Stuart, because maybe even 50% or more of service members have gotten COVID, they've recovered, and they now have demonstrated natural immunity via the presence of antibodies. Okay.
Right.
And again, I'll just be candid. That's me. All right. I have a positive antibody test. In fact, my doctor, I remember her words. She said, congratulations, you have natural immunity.
Huh.
And if I can show that, I believe, this is just my opinion as an attorney, that demonstrated natural immunity accomplishes the government's objective. Because what did we say their objective was?
Stopping the spread.
Stopping the spread of the virus. Well, what does the vaccine do?
It stops the spread.
It stops the spread via immunization, right? Immunity.
Right.
It creates an immunity. It creates it artificially. If my body has already done naturally, according to my doctor and according to my blood test results, my body is doing naturally what in a needle is done artificially. Why? I believe that I should be able to use that to demonstrate I've already accomplished what you're trying to, what your compelling interest is,
right,
in a far less restrictive way on my religious liberty. So I think that's, those are the two, that's a 1-2 punch that's very powerful in terms of grounds for appeal. One, the government's not even following its own regulations. And two, it didn't satisfy strict scrutiny, that legal standard of, you know, the 1-2 step that they have to do.
Right. Now, this is in real time. It's not theoretical. It's not hypothetical. It's actually happening, and people are dealing with it. And the next question deals with that. They say, my unit is punishing me while my religious accommodation is pending. Is this lawful?
Yeah, and I touched on this a moment ago.
You did.
Absolutely not. It is not lawful for you to be punished administratively, disciplinary, etc. You can't be removed from a promotion list. You can't be... Now, certain operational requirements like, you know, flight status, etc., those are more gray area because there might be operational necessities involved. But in terms of actual punishment, right, something that can't be reversed, like if you get NJP'd or Article 15, as they call it in the Army, if you receive a GOMAR, a General Officer Memorandum of Reprimand, a letter of admonishment, anything like that that's now stuck on your record, all right, then that's a form of punishment or adverse action, and it's unlawful. You need to absolutely document that and include that in your appeal, that I was punished, right, while my religious accommodation request was pending. And legally speaking, as I'm going to reiterate this point, legally speaking, while your accommodation request is pending, you have to be treated as if you are fully compliant with the directive.
Yeah. All right, next question. Can I challenge the vaccine mandate because, and this is Pfizer's name, their brand name for the drug, Comirnaty, I believe is how they're saying it, is the only FDA-approved vaccine, and the one DOD is providing is only under an EUA or an experimental use?
This is probably the most common question that we've gotten that is not directly related to religious liberty, right? The Comirnaty versus the BioNTech question.
Yeah.
Because the Comirnaty is the one that is the one that's actually FDA approved, and DOD or FDA said, but the Comirnaty won't actually begin full production until I think 2023 or something like that, and so the DOD is providing one that is called BioNTech that is under an emergency use authorization. So you have the difference between an FDA approved and an EUA, right? And legally speaking, right, the DOD should only have the authority to require you to get one that has full FDA approval and not one that has EUA approval.
Right.
But then the FDA and the DOD have issued these memoranda saying, well, even though they're legally distinct products or vaccines, they're actually interchangeable. Now, again, I'm not a medical expert, so I can't delve into what makes them different or legally distinct or whatever. Here's what I will say in terms of, can I use that as the basis of my challenge? I certainly think that it's probably worthwhile to include that as a secondary or even tertiary point to your religious accommodation request, but I would not make that the centerpiece of your request. The reason I say that is I really believe that it's a delaying tactic. It's not a winning strategy, it's a delaying tactic, because it's only a matter of time before BioNTech and all these other variants start to get approval. The other reason I say that is my fear is that if somebody walks into court to challenge this and says, DOD said get the FDA-approved vaccine, the only one that's FDA-approved is Comirnaty, and they're not providing me Comirnaty, they're providing me with something different. If I'm the DOD and if I'm the DOD's lawyers, I tell the judge, you know what, Your Honor, let's push time out. I'll be right back. I'm going to go get that Comirnaty, and I'm going to bring it here, and then now the guy has to take it, right? Yeah. So that's my question to any service member who raises this argument, as I say, if DOD is able to provide you with the Comirnaty, are you still going to object on religious grounds? Or so is your objection that they're interchangeable and you don't believe they're interchangeable, or is your objection to a religious objection to vaccines? Because if it's a religious objection to vaccines, then it shouldn't matter whether it's Comirnaty or something else.
So legally you're setting a trap for yourself.
Exactly.
If they can come back.
Exactly. So that's why I don't believe that that's the strongest grounds to use.
Okay. Next question. Can I resign or voluntarily separate before my command tries to punish me if I refuse the vaccine?
Another very, very common question. This one is very, the answer, people hate lawyers because we say this. The answer is it depends.
Yeah.
All right. It really does depend. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on what your actual retirement status is, because as most people in the military know, there's such thing as statutory retirement. When you hit a point at which Congress has passed a law, and I believe it's 33 years, after you hit 33 years, you cannot, by law, serve a single day longer. Huh. Like, you're done after 33 years. But prior to that, when people say, I'm retiring, legally speaking, what they're actually doing is they are tendering their resignation to the Department of Defense. They're essentially asking for permission to retire. And that permission has to be granted.
And sometimes it gets turned down. I mean, I've heard cases where people have tried to resign and they said, no, you're going to keep serving.
Exactly. So can I voluntarily separate or retire before my command tries to punish me? And I've heard of a lot of people trying this and it not being successful.
Right.
And that's because... again, it's a contractual obligation, right? There's a contract between two parties, and both parties have to agree.
Right.
And if one party says, well, I want out, and the other party says, well, not until you satisfy fully your obligation to us, then they don't have to necessarily release you. So it gets really complicated, and some of it is a factor of how – I ask people all the time when they ask me that, especially if they're enlisted, because enlisted personnel understand this concept of an enlistment contract, right? For officers, it's a little bit different. But for enlisted, you have a contract that has a term of enlistment. And I say, well, do you still have remaining time on your term of enlistment? And they'll say, yeah, I still have 2 years left. Well,
there you go.
You still have 2 years left on your contract.
Right.
Similarly, for personnel who went through ROTC or attended a service academy or went through pilot training or all different types of schools, I tell them, read the fine print, because let's just use service academies as an example, because I used to teach the Naval Academy, so I'm familiar with this.
Right.
When you go through the service academy and then you go on active duty,
you incur
a particular obligation, and it might be 4 years or 6 years or whatever the case might be. And if you try to leave prior to the expiration of that, I tell them, I said, there's probably a buyout clause where you're going to essentially have to pay money to DOD to buy out of your contract.
Because they invested in your education.
Exactly. You didn't pay a dime for your education.
It's not unreasonable. It's just the way it is.
Right. So the answer to that one is, I realize it's not going to satisfy a lot of people, but I predict that could be very, very difficult for people to try to separate or voluntarily resign early in order to avoid punishment. It doesn't mean you can't try it. I don't foresee a lot of success.
Now, there are many people who work for the Department of Defense who are not wearing a uniform, and this next question deals with them. What is the process for civilians? What legal authority does the Department of Defense have over them when it comes to this vaccine mandate?
So, and this is another great question that a lot of people have asked. If you are a DOD civilian, then it's not always the case. There are circumstances where you're subject to UCMJ, but for the vast majority of DOD civilians, you are not subject to the UCMJ. So that already puts you in a different category. The Uniform Code of Military
Uniform
Justice.
Code, yeah.
I'm probably making the assumption that most of our audience is familiar with that terminology.
Yeah.
I got to stay away from the TLAs, the three-letter acronyms, right?
Yeah.
The DOD has a different type of authority over DOD civilians than it does active or reserve service members, because they don't have the the ability to court-martial a DoD civilian necessarily the way that they would with a service member. And DoD civilians, they also have, there's a different legal regulation that they're subject to. So if I'm a service member and I want to file a religious harassment complaint, I go through what's called the EO process, right? So it's the DoD EO process.
Yeah.
I got that wrong. I'm sorry, I misspoke. The MEO process.
Okay.
It's MEO, Military Equal Opportunity. All right. If I'm a civilian, I go through the DoD EO process. So it's without the M.
Right.
Right. So the M means military, right? Military Equal Opportunity. If you're a civilian, you go through the Equal Opportunity. So really the long story short on this response is they're almost parallel tracks, but they're just governed by different authorities. So if you are a DoD civilian, yes, you have the right to request a religious accommodation, just like service members do. If it's denied, you have the right to appeal it, just like service members do. And if that appeal is denied, you have a right to bring a lawsuit in federal court, just like service members do.
Okay.
It's just that you're falling under. And the one big difference, though, again, is going back to that UCMJ court-martial authority. The vast majority of DoD civilians are not going to be subject to court-martial authority. So instead of court-martialing you and trying to throw you in the brig, right, they're just going to fire you. Or they will try to fire you.
Right.
Which, of course, you can challenge, and I would recommend you challenge.
Yeah. So it's essentially analogous to living in two different states where the laws are very similar, but there are some nuances you need to be aware of.
Right.
Is that a good way to think
really
of it?
You're a federal employee. So it's like somebody who works for the Department of Justice or the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You just happen to work for the U.S. Department of Defense.
Right. Okay. All right. Next question. I am in the National Guard. Can my governor's ban on forced vaccination, like we have here in Texas, be used to refuse the DoD mandate?
Another it depends answer, and I'll go a step further, Stuart, and say this is one I need to do some more research on because it's a great question. Whoever asked this, I'm so glad they asked because it's one that I haven't necessarily thought deeply about because I don't get a lot of National Guardsmen or Guardswomen who come to me with these sorts of issues.
Yeah.
But here in Texas, for example, our governor, Governor Abbott, has issued a vaccine prohibition, a mask prohibition, and has authorized the Attorney General of our state to enforce those.
And by prohibition, to be clear, he's saying
you
can't be forced
right.
to take them. You can't be forced to wear a mask. It can't be mandated. But he's not prohibiting them. He's just saying you can't be forced
exactly, to. Exactly. So no governmental entity within the state of Texas can require somebody to wear a mask. Or can require somebody to be vaccinated. If somebody voluntarily chooses to do that, that's their choice, right?
Yeah.
We love freedom in Texas, okay? So, so the question is, well, if that law is in place in my state, wherever you happen to live, but my National Guard Bureau in my state has said you have to get the vaccine, can I use the fact that my governor has banned forced vaccinations as a legal argument? And the answer is that's something that we're going to have to do some research on and maybe provide a follow-up with a response to that, or at least disseminate some information via our website.
I like the fact that you're honest enough to give that answer rather than blowing smoke. Thank you for that, Mike.
Well, the answer is I don't know, but I know how to find the answer.
Yeah.
Right? I can find the answer.
All right. Next question. Under what authority can the Department of Defense determine whether my religious beliefs are real or legitimate? You dealt with this a bit in the first question. Go ahead and summarize that for us.
No authority. None.
Okay.
All right. Nobody in the government ever has the right or the authority to determine whether your beliefs are legitimate, whether they are real, whether they are valid, whether they are reasonable. All right. That is not up for debate, and the Supreme Court has shut that door repeatedly. It's been tried in the past, and it's failed. So any government official who tries, and even if they're a chaplain, I hear this a lot. Well, the chaplain tried to argue with me about the passages of Scripture that I presented as the basis for this. Chaplains can't do it either. Chaplains yeah. should not be doing that.
And they also can't come to you and say that the faith group you belong to says it's okay, so why are you objecting? They can't raise that either.
Yeah, now this is another common one. Catholic service members who say, well, I'm a Catholic. I object to this vaccine because I'm a pro-life Catholic, and I believe that the vaccine was tested, developed, or produced using aborted fetal stem cells, and I have a sincere religious objection to that. Okay, that is absolutely a valid religious objection. Okay, I can say that because I'm speaking as, you know, a citizen here, right? So yeah. I believe that's a valid religious objection. It is wholly inappropriate and illegal for anybody in the government to come to you and say, well, the Pope said that, or the Vatican said that it's okay to get the vaccine. What they're really saying is this: you are not a very good Catholic because you're not following what the Vatican said.
And they don't get to do that.
I mean, absolutely. Nobody can ever do that to you. And that's whether you're a Catholic, whether you're Jewish, you're a Baptist, whatever your religious faith might be. All right, they cannot parade out a religious leader from your group and use that to say you're not doing your religion appropriately or properly.
Yeah.
Because they're the government. Remember that thing called the Establishment Clause that you know, a lot of people seem to forget about conveniently when it comes to issues like this. The government can't start deciding what people's religious beliefs are.
Now, this next question you already answered in some detail earlier. It was, what happens while my religious accommodation is pending? So I'm going to skip on past that one. If you want to rewind a bit, you'll hear the answer to that one. And the final question for you, and this one is interesting because it brings up a mixing of two ideas.
Yeah.
Can I combine my medical concerns with my religious objections in my religious accommodation request? In other words, mixing the concerns about maybe some medical outcome that may happen because of the vaccine in with your religious accommodation. Should you put the two together?
You absolutely can. All right. Again, it's individualized. Tailor your religious accommodation request to your specific life circumstances, your faith beliefs, okay, whatever those might be. And if you have a medical concern about the vaccine, whether it's the use of mRNA, whether it is simply that I don't like to put things in my body that I'm not comfortable with, that haven't been tested properly, right? And your medical concern is informed by your religious beliefs, right? So I'll offer an example, right? So if it's the concern about putting something in your body that you don't feel comfortable with, but purely from a medical and wellness standpoint, but you are a Christian and you believe that 1 Corinthians 6 says that you should not put anything unclean in your body, okay? Yes, you are absolutely free to say, the term I use is nest your medical concern within your religious accommodation request, right? Okay. To say, look, as a Christian, I believe that it's important to maintain my body as the temple of God, okay? That God created my body and that it is to be a temple to him, that I'm to edify and glorify God, all right, through my body and through how I keep my body. That's why I eat healthy, I get physical, regularly do exercise and physical fitness, et cetera, all right? And so because of my sincerely held religious beliefs, I have this medical objection, yes. Weave them together in your request, right? And I actually think that makes a very powerful argument that, again, it doesn't matter whether you or me or anybody else looks at it and says, well, I can poke holes in that. The government doesn't get the right to poke holes in it, right? The government doesn't get the right to determine whether that's reasonable or not.
Yeah.
Only you, the individual, gets to make that decision.
Now, because of the aspects of this we're talking about all deal with religious accommodations, I just want to reiterate, we're not making claims about whether you should get the vaccine or not. You're a smart person. You get to choose that. But what we are discussing is what the legal options are under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, should you choose not to take it. But again, it's up to you to make that choice. And we're not taking a position one way or the other about the medical efficacy of it or anything else. We're just talking about the environment that you're in legally.
We're about freedom. This is about freedom, right? And religious freedom. And I just never thought I'd see the day that our government, and especially the Department of Defense, would be telling people, you must do this to your body or else.
And what I'm hearing from you, because this isn't just a legal novelty to you, I'm hearing passion from you about this topic, and that's what it comes down to, is what you just said, right?
That's right. This is ultimately about the Constitution, and what does the Constitution say? And I don't say that as a cliche or to be flippant, because I recognize that most of the people who are tuning into this, Stuart, are people who actually raised their hand and swore an oath to uphold and defend that Constitution, right? And so, like me, I assume that they believe that that very same Constitution that I swore an oath to uphold and defend, it should also apply to me.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
The mere fact that I put on a uniform to defend that Constitution doesn't mean that it somehow magically doesn't apply to me anymore. All right? And so that's one of the things that we continually try to remind everybody in America at First Liberty is our service members give up many freedoms when they join the military, right?
But not all of them.
But they don't give up religious freedom.
Right.
No court and no law has ever said service members give up religious freedom when they join the military.
Very good. Anything else you'd like to share to wrap this up before I move on?
I want to lay out at least sort of a procedural timeline for people to have a clear understanding of how this should work, right? I submit a religious accommodation request. And speaking of timelines, every service has provided different deadlines. So you need to look up what your service is and what the deadline is. And then even from there, different commands have, you know, sort of walked back that deadline and said, well, we need your request to be in by this date. I recommend, even though it's really annoying to me, because I don't think they should have the right to do that, but I think you need to be professional. You need to be tactful and diplomatic. So yes, sort of satisfy all their little procedural hurdles
and get it in early.
Get it in when they ask for it.
Yeah.
All right, and then and use the forms that they want you to use. Have everything filled out properly so that they can't ding you on that. Is really the main point.
Right.
Submit the religious accommodation request. All right, on time, using the proper format, etc. If it's denied, you then have. Again, a certain amount of time, depending on what service you're in, usually it's going to be around 10 days to submit your appeal request. And that appeal request goes all the way up to the service secretary for your branch of service. If that's denied, still not the end of the road for you. If that's denied, you have the right to sue in federal court. Okay? And so my recommendation, if you decide to pursue that as an option, that you need to look for an attorney. At First Liberty, we do all of our cases pro bono, free of charge. So there's no possible way, we just don't have the bandwidth, the capacity, or the resources to represent the hundreds, possibly thousands of service members who are going to be in this situation. We have to pick the strategically best cases that we can bring in order to try to, to secure religious freedom for everybody. So we have to look at what are the best fact patterns, the best jurisdictions, et cetera, the worst denials, sort of like these, and then bring the strongest legal arguments we can. But just because we're not able to represent you doesn't mean that you cannot or should not pursue your own legal recourse. So again, I recommend if you get a denial from your unit, so to speak, and then a denial from your service secretary, you should talk to a lawyer about suing in federal court and seeing if that's a good option for you.
All right. Mike, thank you so much for all your insights today. Very helpful. Thank you for your service.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be here with you, Stuart. I wish it was under different circumstances.
Yeah.
But my last word of advice to everybody out there, stay strong. Okay? Stay strong. Stay firm in your faith. Stay firm in your confidence in our Constitution. Our Constitution is a great Constitution, and all it takes is for us to take a stand for our constitutional rights to be defended and to continue to be strong. Remember President Reagan saying that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction, right? We don't pass it on in the bloodstream. We have to fight for it and defend it, and that's what First Liberty is here for. And there is strength and safety in numbers, all right? So please, stay strong.
Very good. Thanks again, Mike. Hey, a couple of things for you before we go. First, Mike shared a lot of insight here today that we hope is helpful to you. again, our primary directive for you is if you decide to go down this path, you want to seek your own attorney and use your personal attorney to get advice specific to your situation, because there are a lot of outcomes that could happen with this, and you want to make sure that you are properly represented there where you are. Second, we've put together a one sheet for you that summarizes the points that Mike made today. This is just a simple explanation of a lot of the key points that he raised. There's a link in the text that goes with this video to that. If you're on our firstlibertylive.com page, as we're doing this live, there's a banner at the top where you can click and link that. Or if you're finding this elsewhere, just look in the text that goes along with it. And it's free. We just want you to have that as a summary to maybe help you make your choices as you go down this road. Hey, this is a special edition of First Liberty Live. On Thursday, we'll be back to our regular schedule. We'll have a live interview talking about the recent firing of two flight attendants from their woke airline because they raised a question about a controversial bill in Congress that the airline was supporting. All they did was raise a question and they both got fired. We're representing them here and we'll talk about updates to that case as we go along. So we will see you Thursday right here on First Liberty Live.